Fascism, What It Is and How to Fight It, by Leon Trotsky. 1969 Pamphlet Introduction, by George Lavin Wiseman. Liberals, and even more of those who consider themselves Marxists, are guilty of using the word fascist very loosely today. They fling it around as an epithet or political swear word against right-wing figures whom they particularly despise, or against reactionaries in general. Since World War II, the fascist label has been applied to such figures and movements as Gerald L.K. Smith, Senator Joseph McCarthy, Senator Eastland, Barry Goldwater, the Minutemen, the John Birch Society, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George Wallace. Now, were all these fascists or just some? If only some, then how does one tell which are and which aren't? Indiscriminate use of the term really reflects vagueness about its meaning. Asked to define fascism, the liberal replies in such terms as dictatorship, mass neurosis, anti-Semitism, the power of unscrupulous propaganda, the hypnotic effect of a mad genius orator on the masses, etc. Impressionism and confusion on the part of liberals is not surprising. But Marxism's superiority consists of its ability to analyze and differentiate among social and political phenomena. That so many of those calling themselves Marxists cannot define fascism any more adequately than the liberals is not wholly their fault. Whether they are aware of it or not, much of their intellectual heritage comes from the social democratic, reformist, socialist, and Stalinist movements, which dominated the left in the 1930s when fascism was scoring victory after victory. These movements not only permitted Nazism to come to power in Germany without a shot being fired against it, but they failed abysmally in understanding the nature and dynamics of fascism and the way to fight it. After fascism's triumph, they had much to hide and so refrained from making a Marxist analysis which would, at least, have educated subsequent generations. But there is a Marxist analysis of fascism. It was made by Leon Trotsky, not as a postmortem, but during the rise of fascism. This was one of Trotsky's great contributions to Marxism. He began the task after Mussolini's victory in Italy in 1922 and brought it to a high point in the years preceding Hitler's triumph in Germany in 1933. In his attempts to awaken the German Communist Party and the Communist International Comintern to the mortal danger and to rally a united front against Nazism, Trotsky made a point-by-point critique of the policies of the Social Democratic and Stalinist parties. This constitutes a compendium of almost all the mistaken, ineffective, and suicidal positions that workers' organizations can take regarding fascism. Since the positions of the German parties range from opportunistic default and betrayal on the right, social democratic, to ultra-left abstentionism and betrayal, Stalinist, the communist movement was still on its ultra-left binge, the so-called third period, when the Nazi movement began to snowball. To the Stalinists, every capitalist party was automatically fascist. Even more catastrophic than this disorienting of the workers was Stalin's famous dictum that, rather than being opposites, fascism and social democracy were twins. The socialists were thereupon dubbed social fascists and regarded as the main enemy. Of course, there could be no united front with social fascist organizations, and those who, like Trotsky, urged such united fronts were also labeled social fascists and treated accordingly. How divorced from reality the Stalinist line was may be illustrated, by recalling its translation into American terms. In the 1932 elections, American Stalinists denounced Franklin Roosevelt as the fascist candidate and Norman Thomas as the social fascist candidate. What was ludicrous as applied to U.S. politics was tragic in Germany and Austria. Recently, 1969, the term social fascism had begun cropping up in articles by members of the New Left. Do those using it imagine that they have invented the term? Or, if they are aware of its history, are they indifferent to its connotations? After the Nazis came to power, the Stalinists boasted that their line had been 100% correct, that Hitler could only last a few months, and that a Soviet Germany would then emerge. The time limit for this miracle was extended from 3, 6 to 9 months, and then the idle boasts dwindled into silence. The magnitude of the defeat suffered by the working class, the special character of fascism, distinguishing it from other reactionary regimes or dictatorships, became apparent to all, and the threat to the Soviet Union or a rearmed German imperialism began to take on reality. This brought about a change in Moscow's line in 1935, and the communist parties throughout the world thereupon zigzagged far to the right even of the Social Democrats. This was their stance in the face of the spreading fascist danger in France and Spain. The military ruin of German and Italian fascism in World War II convinced most people that fascism had been destroyed for good and was so utterly discredited that it could never again entice any followers. Events since then, particularly the emergence of new fascist groups and tendencies in almost every capitalist country, have dispelled such wishful thinking. The illusion that World War II was fought to make the world safe from fascism has gone the way of the earlier illusion that World War I was fought to make the world safe for democracy. The germ of fascism is endemic in capitalism. A crisis can raise it to epidemic proportions unless drastic countermeasures are applied. Since forewarned is forearmed, we offer this new compilation, a small section from Trotsky's writings on the subject, as a weapon for the anti-fascist arsenal. Fascism. What is it? Extracts from a letter to an English comrade, November 15, 1931. Printed in The Militant, January 16, 1932. What is fascism? The name originated in Italy, where all the forms of counter-revolutionary dictatorship, fascist or not, that is to say prior to the advent of fascism in Italy, the former dictatorship in Spain of Primo de Rivera, 1923-1930, is called a fascist dictatorship by the Comintern. Is this correct or not? We believe that it is incorrect. The fascist movement in Italy was a spontaneous movement of large masses, with new leaders from the rank and file. It is a plebeian movement in origin, directed and financed by big capitalist powers. It is issued forth from the petty bourgeoisie, the slum proletariat, and even to a certain extent from the proletarian masses. Mussolini, a former socialist, is a self-made man arising from this movement. Primo de Rivera was an aristocrat. He occupied a high military and bureaucratic post and was chief governor of Catalonia. He accomplished his overthrow with the aid of state and military forces. The dictatorships of Spain and Italy are two totally different forms of dictatorship. It is necessary to distinguish between them. Mussolini had difficulty in reconciling many old military institutions with the fascist militia. This problem did not exist for Primo de Rivera. The movement in Germany is analogous mostly to the Italian. It is a mass movement, with its leaders employing a great deal of socialist demagogy. This is necessary for the creation of the mass movement. The genuine basis for fascism is the petty bourgeoisie. In Italy, it has a very large base, the petty bourgeoisie of the towns and cities and the peasantry. In Germany, likewise, there is a large base for fascism. It may be said, and this is true to a certain extent, that the new middle class, the functionaries of the state, the private administrators, etc., can constitute such a base. But this is a new question that must be analyzed. In order to be capable of foreseeing anything with regard to fascism, it is necessary to have a definition of that idea. What is fascism? What are its base, its form, and its characteristics? How will its development take place? It is necessary to proceed in a scientific and Marxian manner. How Mussolini triumphed. From What Next? Vital Question for the German Proletariat, 1932. At the moment that the normal police and military resources of the bourgeoisie dictatorship, together with their parliamentary screens, no longer suffice to hold society in a state of equilibrium, the turn of the fascist regime arrives. Through the fascist agency, capitalism sets in motion the masses of the crazed petty bourgeoisie and the bands of declassed and demoralized lumpen proletariat. All the countless human beings from whom finance capital itself has brought to desperation and frenzy. From fascism, the bourgeoisie demands a thorough job. Once it has resorted to methods of civil war, it insists on having peace for a period of years. And the fascist agency, by utilizing the petty bourgeoisie as a battering ram, by overwhelming all obstacles in its path, does a thorough job. After fascism is victorious, finance capital directly and immediately gathers into its hands, as in a vise of steel. All the organs and institutions of sovereignty, the executive, administrative, and educational powers of the state, the entire state apparatus together with the Army, the municipalities, the universities, the schools, the press, the trade unions, and the cooperatives. When a state turns fascist, it does not mean only that the forms and methods of government are changed in accordance with the pattern set by Mussolini. The changes in this sphere ultimately play a minor role. But it means, first of all, for the most part, that the workers' organizations are annihilated, that the proletariat is reduced to an amorphous state, and that a system of administration is created which penetrates deeply into the masses and which serves to frustrate the independent crystallization of the proletariat. Therein precisely is the gist of fascism. Italian fascism was the immediate outgrowth of the betrayal by the reformists of the uprising of the Italian proletariat. From the time the First World War ended, there was an upward trend in the revolutionary movement in Italy, and in September 1920, it resulted in the seizure of factories and industries by the workers. The dictatorship of the proletariat was an actual fact. All that was lacking was to organize it and draw from it all the necessary conclusions. The social democracy took fright and sprang back. After its bold and heroic exertions, the proletariat was left facing the void. The disruption of the revolutionary movement became the most important factor in the growth of fascism. In September, the revolutionary advance came to a standstill, and November already witnessed the first major demonstrations of the fascists, the seizure of Bologna. Note, the fascist campaign of violence began in Bologna, November 21, 1920, when the Social Democratic councilmen, victorious in the municipal elections, emerged from City Hall to present the new mayor. They were met by gunfire, in which 10 were killed and 100 wounded. The fascists followed up with punitive expeditions into the surrounding countryside, a stronghold of the Red Leagues, Blackshirt action squadrons and vehicles supplied by big landowners took over villages in lightning raids, beating and killing leftist peasants and labor leaders, wrecking radical headquarters and terrorizing the populace. Emboldened by their easy successes, the fascists then launched large-scale attacks in the big cities. True, the proletariat, even after the September catastrophe, was capable of waging defensive battles. But the social democracy was concerned with only one thing, to withdraw the workers from combat at the cost of one concession after another. The social democracy hoped that the docile conduct of the workers would restore the public opinion of the bourgeoisie against the fascists. Moreover, the reformists even banked strongly upon the help of King Victor Emmanuel. To the last hour, they restrained the workers with might and main from giving battle to Mussolini's bands. It availed them nothing. The crown, along with the upper crust of the bourgeoisie, swung over to the side of fascism. Convinced at the last moment that fascism was not to be checked by obedience, the Social Democrats issued a call to the workers for a general strike. But their proclamation suffered a fiasco. The reformists had dampened the powder so long in their fear lest it should explode that when they finally, with a trembling hand, did apply a burning fuse to it, the powder did not catch. 2 years after its inception, fascism was in power. It entrenched itself, thanks to the facts the first period of its overlordship coincided with a favorable economic conjuncture, which followed the Depression of 1921 through 1922. The fascists crushed the retreating proletariat by the onrushing forces of the petty bourgeoisie. But this was not achieved at a single blow. Even after he assumed power, Mussolini proceeded on his course with due caution. He lacked as yet ready-made models. During the first 2 years, not even the Constitution was altered. The fascist government took on the character of a coalition. In the meantime, the fascist bands were busy at work with clubs, knives, and pistols. Only thus was the fascist government created slowly, which meant the complete strangulation of all independent mass organizations. Mussolini attained this at the cost of bureaucratizing the fascist party itself. After utilizing the onrushing forces of the petty bourgeoisie, fascism strangled it within the vice of the bourgeoisie state. Mussolini could not have done otherwise, for the disillusionment of the masses he had united was precipitating itself into the most immediate danger ahead. Fascism became bureaucratic, approaches very close to other forms of military and police dictatorship. It no longer possesses its former social support. the chief reserve of fascism, the petty bourgeoisie, has been depicted. Only historical inertia enables the fascist government to keep the proletariat in a state of dispersion and helplessness. In its politics, as regards Hitler, the German social democracy has not been able to add a single word. All it does is repeat more ponderously whatever the Italian reformists in their own time performed with greater flights of temperament. The latter explained fascism as a post-war psychosis. The German social democracy sees in it a Versailles or crisis psychosis. In both instances, the reformists shut their eyes to the organic character of fascism as a mass movement growing out of the collapse of capitalism. Note, the Versailles Treaty imposed on Germany after World War I, its most hated feature was the unending tribute to the victorious Allies in the form of reparations for war damages and losses. The crisis, referred to it in the above paragraph, was the economic depression that swept the capitalist world after the Wall Street crash of 1929. Fearful of the revolutionary mobilization of the workers, the Italian reformists banked all their hopes of the state. Their slogan was, "Help, Victor Emmanuel, exert pressure." The German social democracy lacks such a democratic bulwark as a monarch loyal to the Constitution. So they must be content with the president. "Help, Hindenburg, exert pressure." Note, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, 1847 to 1934, Junker general who gained fame in World War I and later became president of the Weimar Republic. In 1932, the Social Democrats supported him for re-election as a lesser evil to the Nazis. He appointed Hitler chancellor in January 1933. While waging battle against Mussolini, that is, while retreating before him, Turati let loose his dazzling motto, "One must have the manhood to be a coward." Filippo Turati, 1857 to 1937, leading reformist theoretician of the Italian Socialist Party. The German reformists are less frisky with their slogans. They demand courage under unpopularity. Mutze unpopularität, which amounts to the same thing. One must not be afraid of the unpopularity which has been aroused by one's own cowardly temporizing with the enemy. Identical causes produce identical effects. Where the march of events depended upon the Social Democratic Party leadership, Hitler's career would be assured. One must admit, however, that the German Communist Party has also learned little from the Italian experience. The Italian Communist Party came into being almost simultaneously with fascism, but the same conditions of revolutionary ebb tide which carried the fascists to power served to deter the development of the Communist Party. It did not give itself an accounting as to the full sweep of the fascist danger. It lulled itself with revolutionary illusions. It was irreconcilably antagonistic to the policy of the United Front. In short, it was stricken with all the infantile diseases. Small wonder, it was only 2 years old. In its eyes, fascism appeared to be only capitalist reaction. The particular traits of fascism, which springs from the mobilization of the petty bourgeoisie against the proletariat, the Communist Party was unable to discern. Italian comrades inform me that, with the sole exception of Gramsci, the Communist Party would not even allow for the possibility of the fascists seizing power. Once the proletarian revolution had suffered defeat, once capitalism had held its ground and the counter-revolution had triumphed, how could there be any further kind of counter-revolutionary upheaval? How could the bourgeoisie rise up against itself? Such was the gist of the political orientation of the Italian Communist Party. Moreover, one must not lose sight of the fact that Italian fascism was then a new phenomena, just in the process of formation. It would not have been an easy task, even for a more experienced party, to distinguish its specific traits. Note, Antonio Gramsci, 1891 to 1937, a founder of the Italian Communist Party, imprisoned by Mussolini in 1926. He died in prison 11 years later. He sent a letter from prison in the name of the Italian Party's political committee protesting Stalin's campaign against the left opposition. Togliatti, then in Moscow, as the Italian representative to the Comintern, suppressed the letter. Throughout the Stalin era, Gramsci's memory was deliberately effaced. In the period of de-Stalinization, however, he was rediscovered by the Italian Communist Party and officially enshrined as a hero and martyr. Since, there has been considerable international acclaim of his theoretical writings, particularly his prison notebooks. The leadership of the German Communist Party today reproduces almost literally the position for which the Italian Communists took their point of departure. Fascism is nothing else but capitalist reaction. From the point of view of the proletariat, the difference between diverse types of capitalist reaction are meaningless. This vulgar radicalism is the less excusable because the German party is much older than the Italian was at a corresponding period. In addition, Marxism is enriched now by the tragic experience in Italy. To insist that fascism is already here, or to deny the very possibility of its coming to power, amounts politically to one and the same thing. By ignoring the specific nature of fascism, the will to fight against it inevitably becomes paralyzed. The brunt of the blame must be borne, of course, by the leadership of the Comintern. Italian communists, above all others, were duty-bound to raise their voices in alarm. But Stalin, together with Magnitsky, compelled them to disavow the most important lessons of their own annihilation. Note, Dmitry Magnitsky, 1883 to 1952, headed the Comintern from 1929 to 1934. His removal heralded switch from ultra-leftism to the opportunism of the Popular Front period. Later appeared on diplomatic stage as delegate to United Nations. We have already observed with what diligent alacrity Ercoli switched over to the position of social fascism, i.e., to the position of passively waiting for the fascist victory in Germany. Note, Ercoli, Comintern, pen name of Palermo Tagliati, headed Italian Communist Party after Gramsci's imprisonment. He survived all zigzags in Comintern line, but after Stalin's death, he criticized Stalin's rule as well some of its continuing features in the USSR and international communist movement. The fascist danger looms in Germany. From the turn in the Communist International and the German situation, 1930. The official press of the Comintern is now depicting the results of the September 1930 German elections as a prodigious victory of communism, which places on the order of the day the slogan of Soviet Germany. The bureaucratic optimists do not want to reflect upon the meaning of the relation of forces which is disclosed by the election statistics. They examine the figure of the increased communist vote independently of the revolutionary tasks created by the situation and the obstacles it sets up. The Communist Party received around 4,600,000 votes as against 3,300,000 in 1928. From the viewpoint of normal parliamentary mechanics, the gain of 1,300,000 votes is considerable, even if we take into consideration the rise in the total number of voters. But the gain of the party pales completely beside the leap of fascism from 800,000 to 6,400,000 votes. Of no less important significance for evaluation the elections is the fact that the social democracy, in spite of substantial losses, retained its basic cadres and still received a considerable greater number of workers' votes, 8,600,000, than the Communist Party. Meanwhile, if we should ask ourselves, what combination of international and domestic circumstances could be capable of turning the working class towards communism with great velocity? We could not find an example of more favorable circumstances for such a turn than the situation in present-day Germany, Jung's noose, the economic crisis, the disintegration of the rules, the crisis of parliamentarianism, the terrific self-exposure of the social democracy in power. From the viewpoint of these concrete historical circumstances, the specific gravity of the German Communist Party in the social life of the country, in spite of the gain of 1,300,000 votes, remains proportionately small. Note, Jung's noose, a reference to the Jung Plan, after Owen D. Jung, American big businessman, who was agent general for the German reparations during the 1920s, In summer of 1929, he was chairman of the conference which adopted his plan, which replaced the unsuccessful Dawes plan to facilitate Germany's payment of reparations as per the Treaty of Versailles. The weakness of the position of communism, inextricably bound up with the policy and regime of the Comintern, is revealed more clearly if we compare the present social weight of the Communist Party with those concrete and unpostponable tasks which the present historical circumstances put before it. It is true that the Communist Party itself did not expect such a gain, but this proves that under the blows of mistakes and defeats, the leadership of the Communist parties has become unused to big aims and perspectives. If yesterday it underestimated its own possibilities, then today it once more underestimates the difficulties. In this way, one danger is multiplied by another. In the meantime, the first characteristic of a really revolutionary party is to be able to look reality in the face. In order that the social crisis may bring about the proletarian revolution, it is necessary that, besides other conditions, a decisive shift of the petty bourgeoisie classes occurs in the direction of the proletariat. This gives the proletariat a chance to put itself at the head of the nation as its leader. The last election revealed, and this is where its principal symptomatic significance lies, a shift in the opposite direction. Under the blows of the crises, the petty bourgeoisie swung not in the direction of the proletarian revolution, but in the direction of the most extreme imperialist reaction, pulling behind it considerable sections of the proletariat. The gigantic growth of National Socialism is an expression of two factors, a deep social crisis, throwing the petty bourgeoisie masses off balance, and the lack of a revolutionary party that would be regarded by the masses of the people as an acknowledged revolutionary leader. If the Communist Party is the party of revolutionary hope, then fascism as a mass movement is the party of counter-revolutionary despair. When revolutionary hope embraces the whole proletarian mass, it inevitably pulls behind it on the road of revolution considerable and growing sections of the petty bourgeoisie. Precisely in this sphere, the election revealed the opposite picture. Counter-revolutionary despair embraced the petty bourgeoisie mass with such a force that it drew behind it many sections of the proletariat. Fascism in Germany has become a real danger. As an acute expression of the helpless position of the bourgeoisie regime, the conservative role of the social democracy in this regime, and the accumulated powerlessness of the Communist Party to abolish it, whoever denies this is either blind or a braggart. The danger acquires particular acuteness in connection with the question of the tempo of development, which does not depend upon us alone. The malarial character of the political curve revealed by the election speaks for the fact that the tempo of development of the national crises may turn out to be very speedy. In other words, the course of events in the very near future may resurrect in Germany on a new historical plane. The old tragic contradiction between the maturity of a revolutionary situation, on the other hand, and the weakness and strategical impotence of the revolutionary party, on the other. This must be said clearly, openly, and above all, in time. Can the strength of the conservative resistance of the social democratic workers be calculated beforehand? It cannot. In the light of the events of the past year, this strength seems to be gigantic. But the truth is that what helped most of all to weld together social democracy was the wrong policy of the Communist Party, which found its highest generalization in the absurd theory of social fascism. To measure the real resistance of the social democratic ranks, a different measuring instrument is required. That is a correct communist tactic. With this condition, and it is not a small condition, the degree of internal unity of the social democracy can be revealed in a comparatively brief period. In a different form, what has been said above also applies to fascism. It emanated, aside from the other conditions present, in the tremblings of the Zinoviev-Stalin strategy. What is its force for offensive? What is its stability? Has it reached its culminating point? As the optimists ex officio, Comintern and Communist Party officials, assure us, or is it only on the first step of the ladder? This cannot be foretold mechanically. It can be determined only through action, precisely in regard to fascism, which is a razor in the hands of the class enemy. The wrong policy of the Comintern may produce fatal results in a brief period. On the other hand, a correct policy, not in such a short period, it is true, can undermine the positions of fascism. Note, Zinoviev Stalin Strategy, Gregory Y. Zinoviev, 1883 to 1936, chairman of the Comintern from its founding in 1919 till his removal by Stalin in 1926. After Lenin's death, Zinoviev and Kamenev made a bloc with Stalin, the Troika, against Trotsky and dominated the Soviet Party. In the period of the Zinoviev-Stalin domination of the Comintern, an opportunist line led to a series of defeats and missed opportunities, most notably the calling off of the German Revolution of 1923. After breaking with Stalin, Zinoviev united his following with the Trotskyist left opposition. But in 1928, after the expulsion from the party of the United Opposition, Zinoviev capitulated to Stalin. Readmitted to the party, he was expelled again in 1932. After disavowal of all critical views, he was again readmitted, but in 1934, he was expelled and imprisoned. He confessed at the first of the great Moscow trials in 1936 and was executed. If the Communist Party, in spite of the exceptionally favorable circumstances, has proved powerless, seriously, to shake the structure of the social democracy with the aid of the formula of social fascism, then real fascism now threatens this structure, no longer with wordy formulae of so-called radicalism, but with the chemical formulas of explosives. No matter how true it is that the social democracy by its whole policy prepared the blossoming of fascism, it is no less true that fascism comes forward as a deadly threat primarily to that same social democracy, all of whose magnificence is inextricably bound with parliamentary, democratic, pacifist forms and methods of government. The policy of a united front of the workers against fascism flows from this situation. It opens up tremendous possibilities to the Communist Party. A condition for success, however, is the rejection of the theory and practice of social fascism, the harm of which becomes a positive measure under the present circumstances. The social crisis will inevitably produce deep cleavages within the social democracy. The radicalization of the masses will affect the social democrats. We will inevitably have to make agreements with various social democratic organizations and factions against fascism, putting definite conditions in this connection to the leaders before the eyes of the masses. We must return from the empty official phrase about the United Front to the policy of the United Front as it was formulated by Lenin and always applied by the Bolsheviks in 1917. An Aesop fable from What Next? Vital Question for the German Proletariat, 1932. A cattle dealer once drove some bulls to the slaughterhouse, and the butcher came night with his sharp knife. "Let us close ranks and jack up this executioner on our horns," suggested one of the bulls. "If you please, in what way is the butcher any worse than the dealer who drove us hither with his cudgel?" replied the bulls, who had received their political education in Manilowski's Institute, the Comintern. "But we shall be able to attend to the dealer as well afterwards." "Nothing doing," replied the bulls, firm in their principles, to the counselor. "You are trying from the left to shield our enemies. You are a social butcher yourself." And they refused to close ranks. The German Cops and Army. From What Next? Vital Question for the German Proletariat, 1932. In case of actual danger, the social democracy banks not on the Iron Front, but on the Prussian police. It is reckoning without its host. The fact that the police was originally recruited in large numbers from among social democratic workers is absolutely meaningless. Consciousness is determined by environment, even in this instance. The worker who becomes a policeman in the service of the capitalist state is a bourgeoisie cop, not a worker. Of late years, these policemen have had to do much more fighting with revolutionary workers than with Nazi students. Such training does not fail to leave its effects. And above all, every policeman knows that though governments may change, the police remains. Note, the Iron Front, a bloc between several big trade unions and bourgeoisie Republican groups with little or no following or prestige among the masses. It was created by the Social Democrats toward the end of 1931. Combat groups called the Iron Fist were set up within the unions, and workers' sports organizations were brought into the Iron Front. However, its first parades and rallies, at which thousands of workers raised their fists, shouted freedom and swore to defend democracy. The masses in the Social Democratic Party and unions really believed that this organization would be used to stop Hitler. It was not. In its New Year's issue, the theoretical organ of the social democracy, Da Freie Wort, what a wretched sheet, prints an article in which the policies of toleration is expounded in its highest sense. Hitler, it appears, can never come to power against the police and the Reichswehr, German army. Now, according to the Constitution, the Reichswehr is under the command of the President of the Republic. Therefore, fascism, it follows, is not dangerous so long as a president faithful to the Constitution remains at the head of the government. Bruning's regime must be supported until the presidential elections so that a constitutional president may be elected, though an alliance with the parliamentary bourgeoisie and thereby Hitler's road to power will be blocked for another 7 years. Note, Heinrich Bruning was chancellor from 1930 to 1932. Regular parliamentary government in Germany ended in March 1930. There followed a series of Bonapartist regimes, Bruning, von Papen, von Schleicher, i.e. chancellors ruling not by ordinary parliamentary procedures but by emergency decrees. These Bonapartist figures presented themselves as political saviors needed to get the country through its crises and thus as above class and party. They depended not on the old bourgeoisie democratic party system, but on their command of the police, army, and government bureaucracy. Pretending to be saving the nation from the dangers on both the left, socialists and communists, and the right, fascists, they struck their heaviest blows against the left, since their primary interest was saving capitalism. The politicians of reformism, these dexterous wire pullers, artful intriguers and careerists, expert parliamentary and ministerial machinators, are no sooner thrown out of their habitual sphere by the course of events, no sooner are they placed face to face with momentous contingencies that they reveal themselves to be. There is no milder expression for it, inept bodies. To rely upon a president is only to rely upon the government. Faced with the impending clash between the proletariat and the fascist petty bourgeoisie, two camps which together comprise the crushing majority of the German nation, these Marxists from the Vorwärts, principal social democratic newspaper, yelped for the night watchmen to come to their aid. Help, government! Expert pressure! Statt Griff zu! Bourgeoisie, petty bourgeoisie, and proletariat. From The Only Road for Germany, written September 1932, published in the USA, April 1933. Any serious analysis of the political situation must take as its point of departure the mutual relations among the three classes, the bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie, including the peasantry, and the proletariat. The economically powerful big bourgeoisie in itself represents an infinitesimal minority of the nation. To enforce its domination, it must ensure a definite mutual relationship with the petty bourgeoisie and, through its mediation, with the proletariat. To understand the dialectic of the relation among the three classes, we must differentiate three historical stages. At the dawn of capitalistic development, when the bourgeoisie required revolutionary methods to solve its tasks, in the period of bloom and maturity of the capitalist regime, when the bourgeoisie endowed its domination with orderly, pacific, conservative, democratic forms, finally, at the decline of capitalism, when the bourgeoisie is forced to resort to methods of civil war against proletariat to protect its right of exploitation. The political programs characteristic of these three stages, Jacobinism, left wing of petty bourgeoisie forces in Great French Revolution, and most revolutionary phase led by Robespierre, reformist democracy, social democracy included, and fascism, are basically programs of petty bourgeoisie currents. This fact alone, more than anything else, shows of what tremendous, rather of what decisive, importance of self-determination of the petty bourgeois masses of the people is for the whole fate of bourgeois society. Nevertheless, the relationship between the bourgeoisie and its basic social support, the petty bourgeoisie, does not at all rest upon reciprocal confidence and pacific collaboration. In its mass, the petty bourgeoisie is an exploited and disenfranchised class. It regards the bourgeoisie with envy and often with hatred. The bourgeoisie, on the other hand, while utilizing the support of the petty bourgeoisie, distrusts the latter, for it very correctly fears its tendency to break down the barrier set up for it from above. When they were laying out and clearing the road for bourgeois development, the Jacobins engaged at every step in sharp clashes with the bourgeoisie. They served its intransigent struggle against it. After they had culminated their limited historical role, the Jacobins fell, for the domination of capital was predeterminated. For a whole series of stages, the bourgeoisie entrenched its power under the form of parliamentary democracy, even then not peacefully and not voluntarily. The bourgeoisie was mortally afraid of universal suffrage, but in the last instance, it succeeded with the aid of a combination of violent measures and concessions, of privations and reforms, in subordinating within the framework of formal democracy not only the petty bourgeoisie, but in considerable measure also the proletariat by means of the new petty bourgeoisie, the labor aristocracy. In August 1914, the imperialist bourgeoisie was able, with the means of parliamentary democracy, to lead millions of workers and peasants into the war. Note, August 4, 1914, collapse of the Second International. The German Social Democratic Party representatives in the Reichstag voted for the war budget of the imperialist governments. On the same day, representatives of the French Socialist Party did likewise in the Chamber of Deputies. But precisely with the war begins the distinct decline of capitalism and, above all, of its democratic form of domination. It is now no longer a matter of new reforms and alms, but of cutting down and abolishing the old ones. Therewith, the bourgeoisie comes into conflict, into only with the institutions of proletarian democracy, trade unions and political parties, but also with parliamentary democracy, within the framework of which arose the labor organizations. Therefore, the campaign against Marxism, on the one hand, and against democratic parliamentarism, on the other. But just as the summits of liberal bourgeoisie in its time were unable, by their own force alone, to get rid of feudalism, monarchy, and the church, so the magnates of finance capital were unable, by their force alone, to cope with the proletariat. They need the support of the petty bourgeoisie. For this purpose, it must be whipped up, put on its feet, mobilized, armed. But this method has its dangers. While it makes use of fascism, the bourgeoisie nevertheless fears it. Pilsudski was forced in May 1926 to save bourgeois society by a coup d'etat directed against the traditional parties of the Polish bourgeoisie. The matter went so far that the official leader of the Polish Communist Party, Worski, who came over from Rosa Luxemburg, not to Lenin but to Stalin, took the coup d'etat of Pilsudski to be the road of the revolutionary democratic dictatorship and called upon the workers to support Pilsudski. Note, Joseph Pilsudski, 1876 to 1935. Originally a socialist with nationalistic views, in 1920 he led the anti-Soviet forces in Poland. In 1926, he led a coup d'etat and established a fascist dictatorship. Worski, friend of Rosa Luxemburg, he supported her differences with the Bolsheviks. When Comintern zigzagged to the left in its third period phase, Worski was demoted from leadership in the Polish Communist Party, but not expelled. He disappeared in the USSR during the Great